Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Today you'll hear two green broadcasters meet on the air. Matt and Alex ask how cities can work in the climate energy crunch. Should you get out? And what can we learn from the back to the land movement of the 1970s? I'll toss in the mental survival tips I use to get through the awful knowledge of climate change. We'll top that off with 15 minutes from the master, Al Gore's latest testimony to the House Energy Subcommittee, April 24th. The last American hope to save the climate. Too much audio, too little time. Let's get to our feature interview. It's Alex Smith here for Radio EcoShock, and I have the pleasure to do something I haven't done before. I'm meeting somebody brand new for the first time in a way, person to person. I have Matt here from Healing the Earth Radio in Guelph, Ontario. But I do feel like I know you, Matt, because I've listened to so many of your interviews. My own show goes out to people across Canada and in the United States. I've got probably as many American listeners now as I do Canadian. And I think your show, you've had American guests, you've had a fair number of downloads, I'm willing to bet, from people in the States and from all over the world. That's one of the neat things about this new media is you say, well, I'm from here or I'm from there, but people get it from all over. I'm wondering if you could do just a brief description of what your show is and why you're doing it.
Yeah, well, once again, my name is Matt. I produce Healing the Earth Radio in Guelph, Ontario. It's a city just west of Toronto. And Healing the Earth Radio started in the spring of, or summer of 2005. So yeah, it started out with an environmental show, but then it has grown to connect with many of the different communities of people trying to create a better world, lots of different First Nations, Native communities, lots of things looking into psychology and emotional health, lots of things talking about reconnecting with the earth in different ways, as well as the science-based stuff and the activism stuff as well.
I think that's something that is remarkable about your show is the activism that I've heard there. And you do find guests who just aren't anywhere else. So I really encourage people to get to your website and start listening to those. We've had an online debate a little bit about Derek Jensen. I know you just had two guests who are discussing his new book, the third book on the Endgame series. And he doesn't shy away from saying, well, we may have to fight to save the earth. That appeals to some young people and maybe to some older people. And I'm always the Mr. Gandhi guy, but I have to say that the nonviolent approach, we can't say that it's worked. The earth is in tough and terrible shape. We may be heading into bad climate change. So it's a very narrow balancing line, and I'm wondering how you handle that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. I just want to see a world that I can live in when I'm your age, you know? Perhaps Derek Jensen is one of the most prominent vocal advocates for, you know, sabotage and stuff like that. Maybe attract some people who do see more of a hope in that out of a failure of everything else. Not everything else, but out of a, you know, a lack of change which we've seen. But I don't know. In that interview, I think you're mentioning, it was with Eric McBay and Lear Keith. I think they're both working on the book together with Derek. And Lear was talking about how she is actually a big fan of nonviolent civil disobedience and how in the case of Gandhi, for example, he had a lot of people on his side. And she was saying that when it works, it's very elegant when it works, but you need a massive number of people to do it. And she's lamenting the fact that there are so few people who seem willing to really change their lives or do something different than the status quo to really recognize the scale of the crises and how drastically we need change right now. So I think that's where that's coming. They're trying to figure out what will be effective to bring about a living world. But me, myself, I'm not interested in being an advocate of any of that stuff personally or taking part in it. I'm pretty happy with the stuff that I'm doing myself right now in Guelph. But I do enjoy interviewing people like that too, because I guess people thinking, and I know 3 years ago I brought Derek Jensen to Guelph for an event, and it was a standing room only crowd with about 220 people or so. you know, a lot of people left, you know, partway through. A lot of people left angry, you know, and I think it spurred dozens of, who knows how many different conversations it spurred in the weeks and months following, different conversations around dinner tables and whatnot. And I think that's really great, even if people don't agree with that kind of thing. I just think getting these voices out there and getting different kinds of voices out there is really good, so people at least know what they don't agree with and know why they don't agree with that and know what they do like and why. And instead of just, I don't know, it's really good to be challenged, I think. And I kind of like interviewing people who are a bit more radical sometimes. I wouldn't say that characterizes my show, but every now and then I think it's good just to see what other people are thinking.
You know, one case that really frosts me is Jeff Lures, I guess that's how you pronounce his name, who was, you know, he went to a car dealership just as everybody was bringing out the Hummer and all the big SUVs, and he just couldn't take it that society was going so far wrong. And he burned three SUVs in a dealer's parking lot. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was around. And in fact, they rebuilt the SUVs and resold them, I'm told. But he got 10 years, or maybe it was originally 20 and they dropped it to 10. And now he's going to get out next December. And he kept up somehow an internet journal, and people kept in touch with him while he was in prison. I'm wondering, you know, looking back, when we see what's happened with climate change and when we see what the energy cost has been just to the economy, all this money heading out to the Saudis and who knows who else, that Jeff was kind of a hero in a way. And if the car companies had listened to him and listened to all the people who said, don't build these things to get 8 or 9 miles to the gallon, perhaps GM wouldn't be going bankrupt right now, and Chrysler and Ford, they wouldn't be in this big trouble. And a lot of environmentalists went the other route. The Rainforest Action Network went up to the top and talked to the Ford people and said, you're on the wrong route. We can give you some alternatives. They didn't listen. So I wonder if we'll be going back and reevaluating people like Jeff Lures. And, you know, I'd like to see him compensated, frankly.
That's a good point. It's interesting. I have kept up, like, somehow I got on his mailing list. I keep getting these emails from him every now and then. And he writes really intelligently about climate change, and he comments on the United Nations conferences each year. And I remember recalling that when he got resentenced from 22 or whatever it was to 10 years, the judge in the case commented on his writing in his defense, what he had to say for himself. And the judge said that it was the most inspiring or remarkable piece of writing he'd ever seen in his whole career come out of this young man. And he was so impressed with his intelligence and what he had to say and how much he wanted to improve the world. And I thought that was pretty interesting, because it's easy, I guess, for some people who don't look into things and who would read the papers, perspectives of these people as extremists or terrorists, as they're now called. But in fact, he was proven to have a really intelligent analysis, and he intended to do that action, I guess, to kind of maybe shock people or wake people up, and kind of, I don't really know what his intentions were exactly, but to do something else a bit more drastic, I guess. Maybe to draw attention to how big of a crisis he saw it as back in 1999 or whenever that was. I was actually reading an article today about how before the turn of the century, people who did kind of, you know, anti-development sabotage kind of stuff were regarded by the authorities as largest apolitical vandals. They're written off as vandals, misguided young people and stuff like that. But this article was trying to make the point that with so much funding going towards anti-terrorism stuff after 2001, the 9/11 attacks, and with so few people to apprehend, they started looking at these environmental animal rights activists who were really inflicting a lot of economic damage onto the corporations they're targeting through consistent campaigns, sometimes involving illegal stuff, mostly just involving legal stuff, and through a very strong lobbying effort on behalf of industry groups and those kind of lobbying efforts, in conjunction working with the FBI and numerous other authorities like that, they kind of rebranded and reprioritized these kind of activists as no longer apolitical vandals, but actually terrorists. And then with the huge the Green Scare wrap-up, you know, the Green Scare arrests from 2005, 2006, where they arrested nearly 20 people for crimes from, like, nearly 8 years ago, calling them all terrorists. They, of course, got to justify the amount of money they spend into anti-terrorist funding, yet none of the crimes people committed even came close to harming a single person except corporate profits. So I thought that was an interesting perspective on the article. And I don't know, it's hard to say how future generations will look upon people today. I daydream sometimes about the headlines in the future, you know, if there are newspapers in the future, or the history books or whatever, the oral history, whatever is around, what will be passed on. I mean, I imagine to the great-great-grandchildren or the future generations of today that it'll be so painstakingly obvious, even to ourselves reading the papers and seeing the headlines that pop up, it's so obvious how dire things are. And especially when you get into the articles that only make it to the European press, say, and not to the North American media with regards to climate collapse and all that. I imagine people will wonder, what the heck were they doing, you know? What were they doing buying electric cars and changing their light bulbs and all that kind of stuff? Which, of course, is good to live a lesser footprint on the earth, but I just use those as two common things people attach onto because they want to do something good, but they're often keep the whole system propped up and chugging along, you know? So who's to say if people will wish there had been a whole wave of, you know, environmental guerrilla people, you know, preventing the industry from continuing. Who knows if people will wish that. I guess they would wish that we had done whatever possible to just stop the destruction of the earth and get back in harmony with it. But it's very complex when it's in the real world, and those things involve great risks and are often, yeah, it's hard to justify some things too that some people advocate as well.
Well, and, you know, now it seems like it turns out what we thought were the pillars of our economy was a pirate economy, that the bank people, you know, were putting out mortgages and doing all these high-flying things that most of us have never heard of, and it turns out they're totally insolvent. And that's been some good news for the environment in a way that people have reassessed going to the mall and just shopping. They don't want anything, but they just feel like shopping as an entertainment activity. I think that's coming to a close, we hope. Perhaps the big carbon price raise of last summer will shock some people into changing around. But what I'm worried about is that people are just going to hang on to the way things were as long as they can, which is understandable. I mean, we all like three meals a day. We like to have a warm house if we can hang on. But there's still a pretty big resistance to making the fundamental changes we're going to have to make to be sustainable, here in this city or to be sustainable in whatever city you live in. Do you think young people are really getting it? I feel like there's a bunch of older talking heads sort of clucking about it, but they're going to pass on, but they're going to leave this damaged world for young people. What are you seeing happening in the universities and in the youth movement?
That's a good question. I guess it depends where you look too. I certainly feel, most times I feel really good about the peers I have in you know, the teens to 30s age group, who I consider you know, some close friends. I have close friends outside of that age group, but I mean the youth you speak of, who I consider part of my community, more or less, are very different than those you might see walking around the average university or something like that. And I do my radio show is at the University of Guelph radio station, and I usually dread going into campus because I just get so down seeing all these people, and I make judgments. I'm knowing I'm judging people based on the way they look, but and all the conversations I hear and everything else, but it's kind of depressing sometimes when I see the majority of people my age, their concerns, their priorities, you know, they're fed on different information than you and I are, and they're part of a drastically different subculture or culture than I'm a part of. But I guess I feel pretty good. I feel like I would like to think that my generation will never, you know, will not give up. I don't know if there'll be any kind of white picket fence life just to sell out to, you know. I feel like I hope we, at least I know many, many people who seem to me to be very committed to getting back in touch with more traditional ways of living, learning gardening, organizing and taking part in seed exchanges and community gardens, you know, having backyard chickens to, you know, I guess bring in their food needs closer to home. Stuff like that, reconnecting with First Nations communities nearby, learning from elders, stuff like that, and defending spaces as well. But it's hard to say. I think I know a lot of people who are involved, but I also live in Guelph, and Guelph is a particularly active community relative to other cities in southern Ontario. Guelph has always had something special about it. I'm not really sure why, but there is something special about it, so I'm kind of blessed and to be there, I feel. I mean, I've chosen to be there, and it's kept me there because it is a really nice place. But it's really hard to answer that question because in some ways I feel really depressed because most people I know my age don't have a clue what's going on, you know, with regards to the larger picture, and don't really care to do anything about it. They still want a good job, they still want a career, they still want a good bank account or whatever. And, but then I do know a lot of people, maybe it's a growing thing, who are really living off the system, who don't really, you know, who don't really take part in the economy much at all, who are more interested in learning to grow food, learning how to, you know, process roadkill and tan hides and make their own clothes and harvest wild plants for medicine and food and grow orchards and stuff like that. And, you know, hitchhike and train hop when they want to travel instead of paying for a bus or having a car, and get food out of dumpsters instead of paying for it from grocery stores, and just living off the enormous excess of this wasteful society, you know. And that's funny how that, because that's spreading as well to older generations. I know a lot of older people now who are realizing there's a lot of free stuff we can find when you walk around your block on garbage night, or in, if you look in the dumpsters behind the grocery store, you'll find a lot of food if they don't lock it up already, you know. I know a lot of young folks my age are pretty disillusioned and disenfranchised and do want something really different, but also they don't really, their voices aren't heard by the decision makers because these young people I'm speaking of don't really see much faith in those kind of institutions ever changing the way we feel we need change to be happening. So there's that kind of distancing as well. It doesn't really answer your question, but it's an attempt.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have seen a couple of positive changes here in this city. For example, I never thought I'd see this. They finally banned lawn chemicals, you know, the herbicides and even the pesticides for lawn. So we've made it so that people will stop poisoning their only possible food source should economic times get really rough, you know, the Victory Garden idea. And there's more talk in the White House even of having their vegetable garden there at the White House. So there's some progressive things happening. I know also here in the city they've recently made it possible to have chickens and passed a bylaw in the area where I live that you can have bees again because we're running short of bees. Mm-hmm. So I feel there's this sort of, maybe the economic crisis has done it, there's this feeling like, oh my God, how would we feed this city? We've already built over the best farmlands, you know, we turned those into paved suburbs. I think some of those suburbs will die off and be plowed up again and grown for food. We'll see. So, you know, there's all of that going on. I wanted to get to you, too, about alternative media, which we're both involved in. We see that the mainstream media is really struggling. It's based on advertising products that suddenly people are suspicious of or can't afford or don't want. So we don't know what's going to happen. And I also know that a whole bunch of investigative reporters have been fired from newspapers and television stations and radio stations across the country. So I think it's going to come more and more down to citizen media. Are we ready? Can we fill that hole? And how do you see people talking to each other if the mainstream media, I mean, they've already been lying to us and not covering the things that need to be covered. But if they disappear altogether, it may come down to radio stations like the one we're in.
Yeah, it's a good point. I do think alternative media is really important, and it certainly has played a really important role in people's movements around the world. If you look at the insurrection in Greece, for example, I know that Twitter stuff and the text messaging played an instrumental role in the news of that teen's murder by the police officer spreading around the city until there were demonstrations before the cops even knew why people were demonstrating, you know, because of this alternative media. Same thing in Oaxaca in Mexico, you know, and I think it was initiated by women teachers, I believe. I'm not so educated on that issue. And they were taking over radio stations and TV stations and then broadcasting their own messages and stuff like that. So you can see how community media has played a huge role in you know, popular struggles and local direct democracy and stuff like that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, wading through the deep green with environmental broadcaster Matt. His long-running show, Healing the Earth, runs out of the University of Guelph in Canada, but his guests, some of them controversial, come from all over the world. Don't forget, we have the latest from Al Gore coming up in our last 15 minutes as well.
Well, getting to the kind of guests that you really enjoy on your show, could you tell me about one or two that have stuck in your mind that you really thought had something for people?
Maybe first off, this woman, Wazia Tawin, comes up. She's a Dakota woman whose homeland is now surrounded by the state of Minnesota, or that's where she's from, St. Paul, Minneapolis area, I think. And she's actually currently working as a professor at the University of Victoria, just across the water here. Wazia Tawin is a wonderful person, and I've spoke with her a couple times on my radio show. And I just finished a book of hers called What Does Decolonization Look Like? I think that's the title. Very interesting stuff, and I guess I mentioned her because she's really influenced the way I think with regards to my place in Southern Ontario, the place I call home, but it would apply equally to anyone else's home. Yeah, and looking at the different histories which came to bring about the city of Guelph, and I guess she just has a really wonderful, useful analysis of colonialism and how it applies to all kinds of stuff, looking at and what decolonization could look like, including everything from diet to governance to spirituality to healthy rivers and healthy land to local non-industrial economies, clothing, the naming of history or the naming of places based on either colonial white men who are often, many cases in her book, in her homeland, were quite often murderous. And renaming places to their traditional names, looking at sacred sites being covered over with forts or malls or whatever, you know. And so she's taking like this huge, all-encompassing analysis of what decolonization could look like and framing it with as well an analysis of moving towards a sustainable world, moving towards a decolonized world and looking at how it doesn't apply just to indigenous people, but it applies to everyone, settlers or not, you know. It's working in my mind in ways I can't really describe, but I really like what she has to say a lot because it gets beyond a lot of the common political talk, the political issues often. It gets something that I feel is much more of a deeper transformation of society that recognizes the historical roots of Canada and the United States, recognizing how they came about and who was displaced or overthrown or killed off to create these economies, which now people talk so much about. And also she really goes in depth into naming and legitimizing the genocide which took place and refusing to have it be belittled or undermined as with words like settlement and discovery and stuff like that. You know, in her case, her people were subjected to concentration camps and the largest hanging on a single gallows that took place ever in the history at Fort Snelling, forced marches, bounties on people's heads to promote killings of people, like all kinds of horrendous stuff. And yet it's the history books mention none of that, you know, and if any of us looked at our own locales, we'd see similar things. And so she's really encouraging people to really look into the history of the places where they live and allow those histories to come to slowly shape how we see the place we live in, and have that history, more of a true history, affect the legitimacy we give to the governments and the economy and stuff like that and the authorities, and really getting into a more of a right relationship with the indigenous people of the place we live. And I mention that because my own life has been quite transformed, you know, through integrating that approach into my own life, through building relationships with people from the Six Nations Reserve, an hour south of Guelph, and the Tandanega Reserve, a few hours east of Guelph. And just through getting in relationships with people of many different sorts, and also helping out when there's, you know, different kinds of land defense actions, like the Caledonia thing that happened in 2006, and really helping out with different things to help get the word out and stuff like that. I have found that when you start getting into those kind of relationships and learning from Indigenous people, it transforms so much of our worldview with regards to spirituality, our place on earth, our destiny, our purpose, our relationship with plants, animals, and waterways. That's so far different than what we hear talked about in the political sphere commonly. So I think that's really, I can't recommend highly enough checking out those interviews on my website, which is resistancesfertile.ca. Checking out her book, What Does Decolonization Look Like? Can be very. It's WAZIYATAWIN, Wazia Tawin. Yeah, I've interviewed her twice, and both have been exceptionally like deep and profound topics, but very accessible to the layperson and not at all alienating or confrontational in my point of view.
Okay, well now I just want to reverse things a little bit. I'm going to hand you back this microphone, and you can ask me any question you like.
Yeah. Oh, great. That's a good idea. You mentioned in one of your emails to me that you had also lived in some kind of land community, some kind of intentional community, or some kind of cooperative living project. I guess I'm curious to know a bit more about that context for you and your shift to living back in a city. And I guess, yeah, because a lot of people of my generation really want to really see the insanity of the city life, you know, and see even this, the enormous requirements of just social organization and feeding large concentrated amounts of people on relatively small amounts of land. So I'm curious to know what you think of what potential there is for a different kind of back to the land movement today, if you see anything is possible. I mean, any mistakes from your time are able to be improved upon, or how that fits into your worldview now.
Well, it's amazing you should say that, because I was thinking just last night that it's possible that a new back to the land movement will come, just out of the economic crisis, but also from the climate crisis and the peak energy situation. And it almost surprised me to think, well, it could happen. When I left society, so to speak, the world was promising to blow itself up with nuclear weapons. We're talking in the late 70s. They had put all these thousands and tens of thousands of nuclear weapons on computer that would react within seconds. But the computer systems were kind of shaky, and we weren't sure who could push the button. And at the same time, these great big nuclear power stations were being built right around the Toronto area. And they were shaky, you know. There was lots of potential for accidents there. And there was also the whole corporate culture. Having gone through the late 60s in university, I just couldn't put on a tie and sell my soul for 30 years and hope there was a pension at the end of it. It just wasn't for me. So, yes. I went back to an area just south of Algonquin Park. There was 200 acres there that had five people living on it. They said, well, you know, a couple thousand bucks, you can become a partner in this thing. And it turned out there were about 500 people who had left and to come to that area because the land was so cheap. And there was a common ethos of we set up a food cooperative, you know, in order to bring in fruits and vegetables and distribute them ourselves and bypass sort of the supermarket system. We had exchanges going on where one person raised a whole bunch of this and somebody else raised the rhubarb or whatever. People started to have kids, and so there was a lot of cooperative child raising going on. Everybody had their own cabin or house, but they weren't very, you know, by today's standards, this was not a $200,000 house. And in fact, the house that we built was mostly built with reused materials by going out and knocking down homes that people didn't want anymore but had really good wood in them and stone and rebuilt that. Gathered stone from right around the stone fences in the farm there to build the chimney, that sort of thing. Cut our own wood for the flooring. So we were trying to live from the resources that are right around us, learned about the wild foods that were there. It's difficult when the winter's 6 or 7 months long to be a vegetarian as such. So some people did, you know, raise chickens or even raise pigs and had a cow for milk or whatever. You had to have a relationship with animals to make it through that kind of thing. What we found was that as the years progressed and society didn't fall apart, it did have a difficult point. Chrysler went bankrupt then, as it's about to do now, in 1981. New York City went bankrupt right in that period. So there were a lot, and interest rates went to 22%. A lot of people did have to walk away from their homes. There's a lot of parallels to what's happening right now. But the situation now, I just had a guest on my show today who said that his grocer in Ottawa, Ontario, knew when the truck was leaving from Vancouver, 5,000 miles away, with his next batch of supplies for his little grocery store in Ottawa. So you got a 5,000-mile-long truck supply line for food. And I know from my own efforts to try and collect food recently here in bulk that there's no food warehouses around to speak of. It's all just-in-time delivery. The truck comes right from Mexico to the doorstep of the IGA or the Super Value or whatever it is and unloads. So it's really fragile, and that would make me very nervous about our food supplies. Also, we've come to the point, certainly in this city and in most American cities, where there's no way the city can feed itself from the immediate environment around it. And so if you're young enough, I'd say this is a really good time to go out and learn how to feed yourself and get back to the land. And I think if you're going to do that, you should take climate change into consideration. Is that river that's running near you still going to run, or is it depending on a glacier that won't be there? If you're in the U.S. Southwest, even though I broadcast in the U.S. Southwest, I have to say this, in the long term, if you're young, get out, because there isn't anywhere near enough water going to be there in 20 or 30 years for all the agricultural needs, much less just the drinking water needs of the people who are living there. People are looking at some parts of sort of mid-northern Canada as good spots because the rain's still going to be there and the heat won't be too extreme. People are picking their spots, but I think you should take that into consideration. We're a couple of generations removed from the people who knew how to raise chickens and who knew how to really grow good gardens that could feed themselves. So people are going to have to actually learn on the net and on Google how to do this. And there are some videos out there, and you can grab the last of the old people before they go and ask them how they did what they did. I don't know if if there's anything that I can really suggest to you that younger people could do better than we did. We still counted on oil to a certain degree. I had a pickup truck we could run into town if we needed something. We didn't use it very often, and the roads were blocked off for about 4 months of the year when we couldn't get to our place by a road. So, as I say, we weren't dependent on that pickup truck. Later on, as we tried to raise more and more food, I did get an old tractor. So we never really totally got off the grid. I didn't have electricity, though, I may say, for 10 years. But we did have a big propane tank out there, so we were still using carbon-based energy for that. Solar panels were too expensive at the time, and wind generators were really expensive, and both of those have come down. So I think there's a lot of hope for people to become much more independent in what they're doing. And I've talked to some young people, and the dream is building out there, and there's a few people are heading up there. It takes at least 2 to 3 years on the piece of ground where you think you're going to live to pick up the rhythms of the seasons, to find out where the resources are, to get your wood supply ready if you're going to use wood heat or whatever you're going to use, to get a building up and to just learn what the heck you're doing and to meet your neighbors, because your neighbors are going to be very, very important to you. Even if they're very different from you, you may have somebody who, you know, families who've been there 50 years or 100 years. Those may be some of the most important people in your life, because they do know how to live there, and they do know where the resources are and where to go out picking berries and the mushrooms at the right times and how to make maple syrup or whatever it is you're going to do. So I really recommend not getting in a silo of just knowing people that are like you, but going out and to meet other people. The big key is to listen and to learn from them. rather than feel like you've got a message to spread to them. If they've been living there for a while, you are the student and you're the one and to be listening. And that's about all I could pass out on that.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm curious. I've learned a lot from your show, actually. Like, I used to be really into researching climate change stuff back in 2004, 2005, 2006, maybe. Got out of it for a couple of years or so. And then I just recently got back into it, and I was learning a lot through some of your shows about that one man. I think he's an Indian man who is looking at how we have 2.4 degrees Celsius warming.
Ramanathan.
Yeah. Kind of showing how we've passed this tipping point. I'm curious to know, from the knowledge of the up-to-date science you have on the climate, how that has been affecting you. Because for me, it made me really sad listening to some of your shows about a month and a half ago or so. Pretty depressing stuff in some ways, and it takes some effort to find the light through it all. So I'm kind of curious to know how it's been affecting you, if you've been able to internalize what that really means, and if so, how that has affected your priorities and stuff like that.
Well, I interviewed a scientist a couple of days ago from Australia, Dr. Glickson, who is one of the scientists who's willing to speak out about our real situation, and he sees us heading for a climate catastrophe. And after the interview, he asked me how I was doing. And I said, well, I have to tell you, I've been a little depressed the last month and a half. I'm wondering, why am I doing this radio show, and am I doing anybody good? Because I haven't seen the changes, that are going to save us anywhere near developing, and it looks bad. So he said to me, well, there are a couple of ways that I handle that. He does believe in Gaia. He's not religious at all, but as a scientist, he does accept James Lovelock's proposition that all the creatures, all the living forms on the earth, are in some way working together to support each other, to make life possible, that even the algae in the sea makes the oxygen that we breathe, and without them, we don't make it. So he feels that it's always possible that this super system may allow us to live. And if so, we may be running around up around the Arctic Sea. It'll be kind of tropical up there. There may be alligators up there. We're talking, we don't know when, 500 years from now or 300 years from now or 100 years from now. We don't know how fast that's going to move. But he says humans are so intelligent that they will work those things out. He has some hope for geoengineering, which I fear myself, but he feels that when our backs are up against the wall, we may learn how to spray seawater into the air and make more cloud cover, which would cool us off long enough that we could dismantle the coal mines and the coal power stations, that we could adapt to some degree. Some people who now live on the tropics are pretty well adapted, and the tropics won't heat up as much as the northern hemisphere and the poles will. So there's some hope that a tropical lifestyle might keep going. And also he started out as a geologist, and he goes way out into the outback of Australia, and he's studying craters that are a couple of miles across where some asteroid hit. And those asteroids, and then the eruption of great mountain chains, changed the climate again and cooled things down quite a bit all of a sudden. So there's also hope that some unseen force, like a lot of Mount Pinatubo is going off at once, could cool things down again, and we might come to our senses and bring some of the carbon out of the air using whatever smart technology we can come through. So I'm just babbling here, but I'm saying nobody knows the future. Certainly I don't. So there's always the possibility that we're in the dark point before that dawn might happen. I don't see the dawn happening through Obama, I have to tell you. Some good things have happened there. He's got some good scientists in place, but it's not moving anywhere fast enough through any of the national governments to save us at this point. But he's also saying that Carl Sagan, the great astronomer, wondered whether we hadn't just had a chance to have a glimpse of what the universe is about, that we represented the universe developing the capability to look at itself. We were like an eye opening. And eyes open and then eyes close. Everybody's eyes open and close. So it could be that that humans as such may not make it. But again, he looked at periods where 95% of all life forms were killed off, where the rocks are almost dead in any record of anything living. And yet, within 10 million years, big life forms developed and a whole raging race of new life came forward from the Earth. So we are not capable in any way of killing off life as such, which is good news. So something is going to follow us if we don't make it, and yet the chances are good that some of us will make it. So he helped me lift some of that depression. And I also say that I'm just really grateful for the fantastic life that I've had. And this is a good time I'm having right now with you. And I know I'm going to have a good time tonight and tomorrow. It's just that ability to enjoy life at the core, even if it's the worst of times and you're going to die tomorrow on the sidewalk out of hunger, today you still have that spark of life in you, and you can't put a price on that. It's just really, really important to find that spark of life and to enjoy it. So I do have the capability to enjoy life despite this terrible news. And somewhere deep in my soul, I never give up hope. I see that things that are beyond my conception have already happened. You know, I couldn't believe that we could be alive at the time of great climate change. And then this economic change as well. And all the things that oil we're going to have to change. Those great things have already happened. So who knows? There could be a fourth and a fifth thing coming down the stream that will make it all worthwhile. That's my feeling.
Yeah. Once again, my name is Matt, and I produce Healing the Earth Radio. Radio show in June of 2009 will be entering its fifth year, and that is produced out of Guelph, Ontario. And the website for the show is www.resistanceisfertile.ca. Thanks.
And I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. It's produced out of CFRO in Vancouver, Canada, and broadcast by 16 stations. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for participating in this conversation. And if you want to go further with that, you can send me an email at any time. My address is radio@ecoshock.org. And I really enjoy getting your email, and I think Matt does too.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. You know, I'd love to hear from you, too. My email address is healingtheearth@resist.ca.
That's it. We're out of here. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that exchange with Matt. It's not easy doing radio about a gorgeous ecosphere under attack, in decline. My hope is kind of lame, but it's still there. Maybe hope is built into all of us, the ultimate survival trait. Here's someone who never gave up, Al Gore. We go now to his testimony to the House Energy Subcommittee, chaired by the remarkable Ed Markey of Massachusetts, as the Obama administration rounds up the evidence for the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. Chairman Markey gets the best and keeps it moving. You can find the whole two-hour video on C-SPAN. Get that link from my blog entry for May 7th, 2009, at our website, ecoshock.org. Here's Al.
Our country is at risk on three fronts. The economic crisis is clear. Our national security remains at risk so long as we remain dangerously dependent on flows of foreign oil from reserves owned by sovereign states that are vulnerable to disruption. The rate of new discoveries, as members of this committee know, is falling, even as demand elsewhere in the world is rising. Most importantly, of course, we are, along with the rest of humanity, facing the dire and growing threat of the climate crisis. It is at the very heart of those threats that this committee and this Congress must direct its focus. I am here today to lend my support to what I believe to be one of the most important pieces of legislation ever introduced in the Congress. I believe this legislation has the moral significance equivalent to that of the civil rights legislation of the 1960s and the Marshall Plan of the late 1940s. By repowering America with a transition to a clean energy economy and ending our dangerous over-reliance on carbon-based fuels, which is, after all, the common thread running through all three of these crises, this bill will simultaneously address the climate crisis, the economic crisis, and the national security threats that stem from our dependence on foreign oil. We cannot afford to wait any longer for this transition. Each day that we continue with the status quo sees more of our fellow Americans struggling to provide for their families. Each day that we continue on our current path, America loses more of its competitive edge. And each day that we wait, we increase the risk that we will leave our children and grandchildren an irreparably damaged planet. Passage of this legislation will restore America's leadership of the world and begin at long last to solve the climate crisis. And it is truly a moral imperative. Moreover, the scientific evidence of how serious this climate crisis is becoming continues to amass week after week. Let me share with you just a few recent examples. The Arctic is warming at an unprecedented rate. New research, which draws upon recently declassified data collected by U.S. nuclear submarines traveling under the Arctic ice cap for the last 50 years, have given us for the first time a three-dimensional view of the ice cap, and researchers at the Naval Postgraduate School have told us that the entire Arctic ice cap, which for most of the last 3 million years has covered an area the size of the lower 48 states, may completely and totally disappear in summer in as little as 5 years. Almost half of the ice in the Arctic cap has already melted during the last 20 years. The dark ocean, once uncovered, absorbs 90% of the solar heat that used to bounce off the highly reflective ice. As a direct consequence, some of the vast amounts of frozen carbon in the permafrost in the land surrounding the Arctic Ocean are beginning to be released as methane as the frozen tundra thaws, threatening a doubling of global warming pollution in the atmosphere unless we take action quickly. Melting of the Greenland ice sheet has reached a new record, which was a staggering 60% above the previous high in 1998. The most recent 11 summers there have all experienced melting greater than the average of the past 35-year time series. Glacial earthquakes have been increasing on Greenland as the meltwater tunnels down through the ice to the bedrock below. Were the Greenland ice sheet to melt, crack up, and slip into the North Atlantic, sea level worldwide would rise almost 20 feet. We already know that the Antarctic Peninsula is warming at 3 to 5 times the global average rate. At the time when I participated in one of the first hearings on global warming on this committee in the 1970s, a researcher warned that an early alarm bell that this crisis was reaching emergency proportions would be if we saw the breakup of large ice sheets on the Antarctic Peninsula. That's why the Larsen, and this warming has already caused the Larsen B ice shelf, which was the size of Rhode Island, to collapse. Several other ice shelves have also collapsed in the last 20 years. Another large shelf, the Wilkins Ice Shelf, which is roughly the size of Northern Ireland, is now beginning to disintegrate right before our very eyes. A recent study in the journal Science has now confirmed that the entire West Antarctic ice sheet is warming. Scientists have told us that if it were to collapse and slide into the sea, we would experience global sea level rise of another 20 feet. Each meter of sea level increase leads to 100 million climate refugees. Recent studies have shown that many coastal areas in the United States are at risk, particularly southern Florida and southern Louisiana. Also, carbon dioxide pollution is now changing the very chemistry of the world ocean. Ocean acidification is already underway and is accelerating. A recent paper published in Science described how the seawater off the coast of Northern California has now already, for some periods of the year, become so acidic from CO2 that it is actually corrosive. To give some sense of perspective, for the last 44 million years, the average pH has been 8.2, and the scientists have at Scripps have now measured levels off the north coast of California and Oregon at a pH of 7.75. Now, the lower the pH, the more acidic of the ocean water. Coral polyps that make reefs and everything in the ocean that makes a shell are now beginning to suffer from a kind of osteoporosis because the acidification levels have reached the state that it begins to dissolve the shells as they are formed. Salmon have now disappeared off the coast of California. Researchers are now working to determine the cause and whether or not this is due to acidity and the relationship between acidity and the so-called dead zones of extreme oxygen depletion that now stretch from the west coast of North America, Central America, and South America almost all the way across the Pacific in a wedge that stretches to the west. The health and productivity of the entire ocean is now at risk. The Union of Forest Research Organizations, with 14 international collaborating partners, have reported that forests may lose their carbon regulating service and that, quote, it could be lost entirely if the Earth heats up 2.5 degrees centigrade. Throughout the American West, tree deaths are now at record levels, with the records being broken year after year. That's the reason why Canada's vast forest has now become a net contributor of CO2 to the atmosphere rather than absorbing it. The Amazon, the forests of Central Africa, Siberia, and Indonesia are all now at risk. This year, a number of groups ranging from the National Audubon Society to the Department of Interior released the U.S. State of the Birds report, showing that nearly a third of the nation's 800 bird species are now endangered, threatened, or in significant decline due to habitat loss, invasive species, and other threats, including climate change. The major shift attributed to the climate crisis related to the migratory patterns and a large, consistent shift northward among a vast range of bird species in the United States. Some of the most intriguing new research is in the area of extreme weather events and rainfall. A recent study by German scientists in the publication Climate Change projects that extreme precipitation will increase significantly in regions that are already experiencing extreme rainfall. Man-made global warming has already increased the moisture content of the air throughout the world, causing bigger downpours. Each additional degree of temperature causes another 7% increase in the moisture content of the world's air and leads to even larger downpours when storm conditions trigger heavy rains and snows. To bring an example of this home, 2009 saw the eighth 10-year flood of Fargo, North Dakota since 1989. Last year in Iowa, Cedar Rapids was hit by a flood that significantly exceeded the 500-year floodplain. All-time flood records are being broken in regions throughout the world. Conversely, those regions that are presently dry are projected to become much drier because higher average temperatures also evaporate the soil moisture. The American West and the Southeast have been experiencing prolonged severe drought and historic water shortages. In a study published in January 2008 in Science, scientists from the Scripps Institute estimated that 60% of the changes in the water cycle in the American West are due to increased atmospheric man-made greenhouse gases. It predicts that although Western states are already struggling to supply water for farms and cities, more severe climatic changes will strain the system even more. Agriculture in our largest farm state, California, is at high risk. Australia has been experiencing what many there call a thousand-year drought, along with record-high temperatures. Some cities had 110 degrees for four straight days 2 months ago. And then, of course, they had the mega fires that caused so much death and destruction. Federal officials from our own National Interagency Fire Center report that we have seen twice as many wildfires during the first 3 months of this year compared to the same period last year. Due to the worsening drought, the outlook for more record fires, especially in Texas, Florida, and California, is not good. A number of new studies continue to show that climate change is increasing the intensity of hurricanes. Although we cannot attribute any particular storm to global warming, we can certainly look at the trend. Dr. Greg Holland from the National Center for Atmospheric Research says that we have already experienced a 300% to 400% increase in Category 5 storms in the past 10 years in the United States. Last August, hundreds of thousands of people had to evacuate as Hurricane Gustav hit the Gulf Coast. And then, of course, there's the destruction of Galveston and areas of New Orleans where the residents are still recovering. The same is happening in the rest of the world. Last year, Cyclone Nargis killed 20,000 people in Myanmar and caused the suffering of tens of thousands more. For these and many, many other reasons, now is the time to act. And luckily, positive change is on the way. In February, when the Congress voted to pass the stimulus bill, it laid the groundwork for critical investments in energy efficiency, renewables, a unified national smart grid, and an historic transition to clean cars. This was a crucial down payment that will create millions of new jobs, hasten our economic recovery, strengthen our national security, and begin solving the climate crisis. But now we must take another step together and pass the American Clean Energy and Security Act. Chairman Waxman and Chairman Markey have pulled together the best ideas in the Congress to begin solving the climate crisis while increasing our energy independence and stimulating our economic recovery. Let me highlight just a few items in the bill that I believe to be of particular importance. First, it promotes the rapid introduction of the clean and renewable technologies that will create new, good, sustainable jobs and reduce our reliance on carbon-based fuels. It is time to close the carbon loophole and begin the steep reductions that we need to make in the pollution that causes global warming. Second, it helps us use energy more efficiently and transmit it over a secure, modernized, digital smart grid system. Of course, this move to repower America must also include adequate provisions to assist those Americans who would face a hardship. For example, we must recognize and protect those who have toiled in dangerous conditions to bring us our present energy supply. I believe we ought to guarantee good jobs for any coal miner displaced by impacts on the coal industry. And this bill also focuses on intensive R&D to explore carbon capture and sequestration to determine whether and where it can be a key part of the solution. I have always strongly supported intensive R&D on carbon capture and sequestration and demonstration projects, and I'm happy that at long last this committee has found a way to do that. Our country cannot afford more of the status quo, more gasoline price instability, more job losses, more outsourcing of factories, more years of sending $2 billion every 24 hours to foreign countries for oil. And our soldiers and their families cannot take another 10 years of repeated troop deployments to regions that just happen to have large oil supplies. Moreover, the best way to secure a global agreement that guarantees that other nations will also reduce their global warming pollution is for our country to lead the world in meeting this historic challenge. The United States of America is the world's leader. We are the only nation in the world that can lead. Once we find and reestablish the moral courage to take on this issue, the rest of the world will come along. Now is the time to act. Before the world gathers in Copenhagen this December to solve this crisis, not next year, this year, I strongly urge bipartisan support of this crucial legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was Al Gore testifying to Congress April 24th on the new climate legislation. Next week, we'll interview climate scientist and activist Bill Hare. His new report says the world may have to stop using fossil fuels completely in just 20 years from now, or face a drastic climate shift. The latest science, the most alarming. I'm Alex Smith. We're out of time. Thank you for caring about your world.